All right, so this is Bio 241. It's February 11th, Thursday. Your first test is the next class session, which is Tuesday. So are you all getting in the holiday spirit? I am. Okay. So don't forget, campus is completely closed tomorrow, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday as well. So the library is going to be closed. Actually, all the buildings are going to be closed. So if you have labs or anything scheduled, forget it. All right, but since you have a test next time, I wrote on the board the things that you need for the test. All right, so you need a Scantron. What should you tell me about this Scantron? Yeah, it's an 882. What else? It should be clean, right? It shouldn't be covered with marks because you're going to lose points when it gets graded. It shouldn't be mutilated. It shouldn't be bent. It should be a nice, clean Scantron. A pencil and an eraser. What should you tell me about this eraser? Yes. All right, take your pencil and on a clean piece of paper, make a line and erase it with your eraser. And if it smudges, throw it out. And go buy one that doesn't smudge up your Scantron. Because again, you're going to lose points because the Scantron reader won't be able to give you a correct reading of it if your Scantron is all smudged up, right? So another thought about marking a Scantron, make sure you don't put any stray marks on your Scantron. Don't write notes someplace because the Scantron reader might not know how to grade your Scantron then, and you're going to get gypped out of points. All right, Cypress College picture ID. You also need that. All my classes need that. Fullerton College is okay as long as it has your ID number on there, and it's the same student ID number that you have here at Cypress College. They should be the same, right? All right, and see what else. Basic scientific calculator. You need that so that you can do log function, so not just something that can do addition and subtraction. All right, so during the test, can you share a Scantron? No. Can you share a pencil? Can you share an eraser? What about a picture ID? What about a scientific calculator? Ah, the answer is your least favorite answer. You cannot share a calculator during the test, right? All right, and when we say basic scientific means that you could have a memory location maybe for a number, but no memory locations for text or functions or any of that kind of stuff. So it can't be programmable. Basic scientific calculator. All right, so we can't share anything during the test. All right, so I'm going to go over the test, I think, just a little bit right now, okay, so we don't have to take a lot of time on Tuesday. But you're probably going to have a lot of time to take the test. But don't forget, it's closed notes, closed book. You can't use anything. All your cell phones have to be turned off during the test. And no hats or hoods can be worn. No sunglasses. All right, so I know we can't sit every other seat in here, so it's just individual effort. You can't look around the room. Can't stare at me, anybody else, anybody else's answer sheet, right? All right, so that's about it. The only other thing is before the test, if you're going to have to go to the bathroom within an hour and a half, go before the test, not during the middle. All right, because I can't let you out of the room until you're done with your test. Right? All right. Any questions on the test that's coming up on Tuesday? Then I'll probably grade them right away, and you'll get them back in lab, and you can have keys there, and then you can check and see what your answers are like. You can check the Scantron. Okay. Oh, one last thing. After I grade a Scantron, and you got a grade, and an instructor gives it back to you, and you take it away from and go work on it at your desk or whatever, all right, then it can't be regraded. So if you want to have it regraded, if you think there are mistakes on it, you and the instructor have to go over it one-on-one right then and there. Okay, so once we hand that back and you take it someplace, then we can't regrade it for you. Okay, so you got to really practice your marking skills on your Scantron. And then I keep the Scantrons, I guess, in perpetuity or something. So after you check it, make sure it's graded correctly, then we get them back and store it in a safe someplace, okay? All right, on the screen, I have your answer key for the quantitative questions, right? That's in Blackboard, so you can practice the end of chapter quantitative questions. And also this morning, I uploaded in course documents the periodic table. If you want to print that out, download it to your computer, maybe pencil in what elements you have to know. Like, give me the name of an element you have to know something about. Hydrogen, carbon. Yeah, what's the chemical symbol for carbon? Yeah, that's an easy one. I probably won't have that on the test. But I could ask you, how many protons are in the nucleus of carbon? Yeah, well, if you memorize that, that's good. But if you don't want to memorize it, you'll have a periodic table, and you can look it up if you know how to use that periodic table, right? Then you should see like a 6 on there. Okay. Now, the one that's that you want to print out at home, I can't let you bring to the test, but I'll have an exact duplicate. Okay, so only these items that are on the board can you bring with you to the test. Everything else just put on the floor. Okay, I think that's it for me. Any questions? Yes?
So when we're done with the test on Tuesday, yeah.
Probably at the end of lab. Yeah, yeah, at the end of lab when you're done with your lab. You'll be able to look it over right then and there. And then, of course, with all your grades, your lab scores and your test scores, go into Blackboard and check to make sure that I entered the correct numbers and that your lab instructors are entering the correct numbers into Blackboard, right? So when you get a quiz back or a test, write your score down and make sure you get credit for that particular number of points, right? Because it's easy to make mistakes when you put things into Blackboard. And a really nasty mistake in Blackboard is that all the cells automatically pop up with a minus sign. And so if an instructor types in the number and they're not really careful, you'll get minus points. You'll get a minus 100%. And, of course, Blackboard just adds things up, and that's, if you get 100%, it will subtract 100 points from your score. So definitely go into Blackboard, make sure those scores are entered correctly. Okay. All right, so last time, what did we learn? We learned something about resting membrane potential. Okay, that across the cell membrane, there is a voltage. And how is the inside compared to the outside? Yeah, it's negative. It's more negative on the inside compared to the outside. And we looked at the Nernst equation, and that tells us for one ion species, what kind of voltage results, all right, when there's a concentration difference from the inside to the outside of the membrane. And you've got some practice equations in these notes, maybe even at the end of the chapter, to use that Nernst equation, and it should remind you a lot of that pH equation, right? So there's just that log function. Okay, there was a table someplace that showed you, here's a good one, right, that shows you four ions and the concentration gradient in a resting cell that you see. So these ions you should know, of course, by their chemical symbol, their English name, and where they're at high concentration, like sodium in a normal resting cell. Where is sodium at high concentration? Inside or outside?
Outside.
Outside. What about potassium?
Inside,
the other way around. What about for chloride?
Outside.
Yeah. And last one, calcium.
Outside.
So calcium actually is extremely low concentration inside the cell. That's an important signaling molecule, right, that changes the activity of a cell dramatically when its concentration increases just a little bit. So it has to be held almost at zero. Okay, so that's good. That's what I really want you to know about these slides here, but also be able to work with this Nernst equation, right? Okay. And don't forget about the sodium-potassium ATP pump. It doesn't pump equal numbers of potassium and sodium. Right, it's 2 potassium for every 3 sodium. You should know the direction that it works. And what kind of transport is that? Anytime you hear a pump, you should realize, yeah, that it's an active process, right? And it's going to require ATP. So if it's going to require ATP, what kind of active process is that?
Primary.
Yeah, it's primary active transport. All right, so ATP is the energy source. If a molecule is moving across a membrane from low concentration to high and ATP is not used directly, right, maybe the energy in some gradient, maybe a sodium gradient is used to move that molecule from low to high, what kind of transport is that? Okay, low to high is active. ATP is not being used, so it is secondary. Yeah, so you guys were right, but I wanted to break it down step by step. Okay. All right, then we started talking about cell signaling. What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? That's a synapse, right? And there are two kinds of synapses. There's chemical and electrical. Okay, so a chemical signal synapse requires something like a neurotransmitter to be released by one cell That neurotransmitter is a chemical. It diffuses to the neighboring cell, and it has to bind to a receptor on that neighboring cell, and then that's going to change the metabolism, or something about the voltage on the neighboring cell is going to change its physiology. All right. An electrical synapse requires that these cells are touching each other, but not just touching each other, what else? There has to be a nice tunnel between them, right? And that's what we call a gap junction. That's so that sodium, once it enters the first cell, changing the electrical properties of the first cell, sodium can then diffuse into the second cell down a concentration gradient, thereby changing the electrical properties of the second cell. And we would just call that, for instance, like a sodium current. Oh, and as a matter of fact, this is where we left off last time. Okay, so let's start right here. Okay, so here is the second kind of synapse that we were talking about. This is the chemical synapse. And your book calls it synaptic signaling. I kind of break it down a little bit differently into electrical and chemical synapses. Okay, so here is a synapse. All right, so these two cells are going to communicate with each other. As a matter of fact, this nerve is going to communicate with this muscle cell. So there's an electrical impulse that comes down this neuron, then down the axon. When that electrical signal reaches this axon terminus right here, it's going to release a chemical that we call a neurotransmitter that's going to move and diffuse and bind to this cell over here, this muscle cell. All right, so what allows this muscle cell to bind this neurotransmitter from a neuron? It's got to have a special membrane component on the plasma membrane, and that's called a receptor. All right, so this muscle cell can respond to this molecule if it has a receptor for it. Okay. All right, so what must be the shape of the binding site of the receptor compared to the shape of the neurotransmitter? Right, they have to be complementary to each other. Maybe I can draw this out really quick. All right, say we got a couple of molecules. We got, that's nice and dark, A, B, C, and D molecule. All right, and then we got a number of different receptors. All right, so here is a receptor right here. Which of these molecules will be able to bind to this receptor and then change the physiology of the cell that contains this receptor right here? B, right, because it's complementary in shape. What about if we have a receptor that looks like this? What's going to bind? Yeah, it's going to be an A. Well, I got a little sloppy with this A right here. Okay. And then if we have a receptor that kind of looks like that, what do we have? What could fit in there? Well, D is going to fit in there, and C might sort of fit in there, right? So these actually could maybe compete with each other for that binding site. Okay. So you have to think of, right, the shape of the receptor has to match up in a complementary sense to the shape of the molecule. And if there's no proper receptor, then that cell is going to be completely blind or insensitive to that particular signaling molecule. Okay, in terms of another mode of operation, we talked about this already, but you might have some cells that secrete a product, and this product doesn't get secreted into a duct, but nonetheless, it's going to travel a long distance to a distant site. So in this diagram right here, how does that signaling molecule move from site number one to a distant site number two over here? If there's no duct that's going to carry it, and it's too far to move by diffusion. So these molecules can diffuse short distances, right? But we see it entering the circulatory system. What kind of blood vessel allows, only capillaries, right? So this molecule can diffuse into the circulatory system where it goes, and once it's in the circulatory system, where does it go? Everywhere in the body, everywhere where blood goes, and then it can leave via capillary, and then here is a target tissue. So in order for this tissue actually to be a target tissue or a target organ, what does it have to have for this particular molecule right here? The proper receptor for it, right? All right, so when you have a gland that secretes a product, not into a duct, what kind of gland is that called? That's an endocrine gland, right? And that product then is what we call a hormone. So there's a lot of definitions that you have to appreciate on this particular slide. Okay, so an endocrine gland is a ductless gland. It doesn't need a duct because it uses the circulatory system to deliver hormones all over the body. And again, what's the shape of the binding site on this target tissue right here compared to the signaling molecule? Right, it works by shape, right, by complementary shape. All right, so there are a number of different kinds of signaling molecules that we have in the body. And this particular diagram right here, we see a nice cell with a nucleus. And if it's a nonpolar signaling molecule, remember a nonpolar molecule can diffuse right across the membrane. So the signaling molecule can directly enter the cell where it binds to a receptor. All right, and then this receptor and hormone complex can diffuse into the nucleus, and this can be a transcription factor. All right, so what does a transcription factor allow the nucleus to do? What's transcription? Yeah, transcription is a process of converting information from DNA into RNA, right? That's transcription. And transcription requires some kind of factor to bind to the DNA to initiate transcription. All right, so this complex right here is a transcription factor which initiates transcription, which then produces messenger RNA, which then can go into the cytoplasm. And then what good is messenger RNA in the cytoplasm? What can happen there? Yeah, because then that's going to be used as the dictionary on how to spell out a protein in terms of its amino acid sequence, right? So then translation can take place, and then the cell builds a new kind of protein, which then changes the structure or the function of this particular cell as a result of this signaling molecule right here. All right, so some examples of these, right? Do you agree that a steroid is nonpolar or hydrophobic? Yeah. Thyroid hormones. Well, we didn't look at that, but those are also hydrophobic. Thyroid hormones can enter the cell directly. And kind of a weird one right here, nitric oxide. That's a gas. That gas can enter the cell and work the same way. All right, so basically, all hydrophobic regulatory molecules or signaling molecules bind to receptors that are cytoplasmic or maybe even nuclear receptors. It can diffuse right into the nucleus. All right, but there's a special problem with a hydrophilic regulatory molecule. Can hydrophilic molecules enter the cell? They're basically blocked all the time. Why is that? Because they can't get through the plasma membrane. Remember, because the internal part of the plasma membrane is hydrophobic. It's a strong hydrophobic region, so it's going to exclude these polar regulatory molecules from entering the cell. Right, but nonetheless, we want to be able to change the metabolism or change the function inside the cell. So that signal somehow has to get inside the cell, and we call that signal transduction. So a polar molecule has to bind to a receptor that is on the plasma membrane facing the outside because this guy can't get inside the cell. So it has to bind to a plasma membrane receptor. All right, so that molecule binds to a receptor, which then causes the production of other kinds of molecules inside the cell. So first messengers are always found, where do you see it? Where do you see it? Outside the cell. Second messengers are always found inside the cell, and these develop as a result of a first messenger binding to a plasma membrane receptor. This process is what we call signal transduction. And a lot of people got some pretty nifty Nobel Prizes trying to figure out how this molecule that's trapped outside the cell can actually change things that happen inside the cell. All right, so here's just a nice simple scheme. So how would you describe why this first messenger can bind to a receptor right here? It's by shape, right? It's got to have the complementary shape. Right, and then this receptor is going to somehow change the chemistry or metabolism inside this cell. All right, so don't forget, first messenger is always located outside. The second messenger is always located inside the cell. Here are some examples of second messengers. right? They could be ions. A good example of that would be, what is this right here? Pop quiz. What is this?
Calcium.
Yeah. And what kind of molecule is calcium? Does it like to dissolve in water, for instance? Does it like to dissolve in water, this calcium right here? It's an ion, right? So ions love to dissolve in water. They're polar compounds. What kind of an ion? What kind of ion is this? It's a cation. It's a bivalent cation, right? Because you see these two pluses right here. Cyclic AMP is another second messenger. We're going to talk about G proteins can be a second messenger. DAG can be a second messenger. This comes from the lipids within a membrane, and IP3 can be a second messenger inside the cell. And we're going to talk about all of these throughout the class, all right? So we're going to find these later on. All right, and in particular, you need to start learning about G proteins, all right? So they're an important part of a second messenger pathway in many cells. You know what? Probably, I would say all cells. And maybe I could even say not all cells in your body, but all cells in general. So we say that these G proteins are highly conserved in biology. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Good, you?
I'm doing good.
Here, you're Mike challenged.
I am Mike challenged. So I don't know if you want to play around with that while I'm goofing around or take a quick look-see. I can proceed, but if you have a question. So I just put that on Mike, and there's no buttons I have to push on that thing, right? Okay. Okay. Okay, so G proteins, we find they're highly conserved. That means all organisms use these things. So that can also be used as what? Evidence of evolution. And it's such a nice signaling transduction mechanism that it really didn't have to be improved upon, right, as life evolved. So it's something that we inherited from even unicellular organisms. That's pretty cool. So I want you to be a little bit excited about these things because they're so old, so many organisms use this as a way to transfer signals from outside the cell to inside the cell, and those signals are what? Hydrophilic signals. They can't enter the cell by themselves. All right, so a G protein contains three units, three subunits. Okay. And these subunits become activated or dissociated when the cell surface receptor is activated. So when I say cell surface receptor, what kind of molecule is going to bind to that receptor? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's going to be hydrophobic, right, because it can't get inside the cell, so there's got to be a receptor in the extracellular fluid, facing the extracellular fluid.
You mean hydrophilic?
Huh? Hydrophilic. Hydrophilic. Yeah, because it can't get through the membrane. All right, so that signaling molecule binds to the receptor and activates these subunits. So here's a general scheme. This is an important exam figure, and you'll probably see this scheme in all the chapters that we're going to talk about from here on out. All right, so do you see a nice phospholipid bilayer? What's that? What's the phospholipid bilayer right there? That's the membrane. What kind of membrane? That's the cell membrane. Yeah, that's a plasma membrane, right? So we're really zooming into a really small part of the cell right there. And you see the receptor dissolved inside the plasma membrane, right? And it's transmembrane. The receptor is facing the outside of the cell. And then the interior of the cell has the G proteins, and they're labeled alpha, beta, and gamma. Do you know what an alpha looks like? That's the first one. Alpha is here, right? Then we got a beta and gamma. Kind of looks something like that. So those are three subunits. Okay, so in order to activate that complex, okay, it has to be charged with energy. All right, and what's the general, what do you understand to be the general form of energy in your body, chemical form of energy in your body is ATP. All right, that's a nucleotide. Well, there are other nucleotides. For instance, like GTP. That's very similar to ATP, but it's a little bit older kind of molecule. All right, but it can carry energy just like ATP does, almost the equivalent amount of energy. All right, that activates the alpha, beta, and gamma units so that when a regulatory molecule binds to the receptor, those G proteins dissociate. So, Mike, thanks for stopping by. Okay. Okay. I don't know if anybody else was trying to use it or not. Okay, so we have the gamma and beta subunit dissociate from the alpha. Okay, now look where these guys go. Right, they're stuck to the inside of the plasma membrane. So if I were to draw, a plasma membrane out right here. Okay, so here is a, can you recognize this as a plasma membrane for sure, right? And what is this internal region? Hydrophobic. Okay, here is the alpha subunit right here. Now, the reason why it's stuck right here is because it has chains that have lipid on them. And where does that lipid like to dissolve? Right in the middle, yeah, of the phospholipid bilayer. So another idea of the plasma membrane is that is it really rigid or is it fluid? It's very fluid. So this alpha subunit can diffuse around, all right, can move around within the on the surface of the plasma membrane because it's kind of stuck to it. All right, so just by diffusion, this can move around attached to this inside surface of the plasma membrane. All right, and it can bump into other things that are in the plasma membrane. So it's going to diffuse around, and then it's going to bump into another protein that's in the plasma membrane, and this right here is what we call an effector. So an effector is going to produce some kind of change. That effector could be, number one, it could be an enzyme. So it's going to catalyze a reaction. It's going to convert one molecule into another kind of molecule. Right. Or number two, it could be a channel. It could be an ion channel. Maybe it's a sodium channel. So when the alpha subunit bumps into that channel, it opens up. And guess what happens to sodium? Where is sodium at a high concentration? Outside the cell. All right. So, and it's low inside, so if that channel opens up, what is sodium going to have a tendency to do? Rush in the cell. Another thing to think about, what is the charge inside the cell? Negative, and what's the charge of sodium that's outside? Positive, is that going to have a tendency to draw sodium in or keep it out? Draw it in. So it's both a concentration gradient and electrical gradient is going to like suck sodium into the cell, and it's going to change the electrical properties of that cell. All right, so these channels are real important. They can be activated by these G proteins. Right? And the same thing for the alpha and gamma subunit. Right? They can wander around on the inside surface of the plasma membrane. They can bump into other effectors, changing the electrical properties of the cell if it's a channel, right? Or changing the metabolism inside the cell if it's an enzyme. So that's a important kind of receptor complex that you should be aware of. So we call that a G protein coupled receptor. Right, so you got the receptor part and then you got the G protein. So how would you activate a G protein? What kind of signaling molecule is going to activate a G protein? And that G protein is what? Is glued to the inside surface of the plasma membrane. How would you activate that alpha, beta, and gamma subunit? How do you activate that? First, it has to be charged, right? It's got to be phosphorylated with a GTP. But it's activated when a signaling molecule binds to the receptor. I just can't get at my cursor very easily here. Okay. So a regulatory molecule binds. So this is the receptor. This is the G protein. And then after it bumps into an effector, right, then it comes back together with this alpha subunit, and the receptor is now recharged again, ready to bind another signaling molecule. That inorganic phosphate is released, and in order for this to work again, we have to spend the GTP so that this process can repeat itself. Okay, so this is a pretty important exam figure, and we're going to build on this throughout the class. So this is just like the first little building block of a G protein coupled receptor. Ah, final point. Okay, what kind of messenger is this regulatory molecule? Where do you see it? Where do you find it? Is it inside the cell or outside?
Outside.
It's outside the cell. So what kind of messenger is that? It's a first messenger, right? You could tell me something about the nature of this molecule. Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic?
Hydrophilic.
It's hydrophilic because it's trapped outside the cell. But this molecule is necessary to change metabolism inside the cell. How does that signal get across? By using these G proteins as second messengers inside the cell. Okay? So once the regulatory molecule binds to a receptor, it releases these G proteins that can then activate different enzymes or channels within the in the membrane. Okay? So these G proteins are where? Inside the cell or outside? They're inside. So would you consider them a first messenger or a second messenger? They're a second messenger. Okay? And so we're taking information from outside the cell and converting it into information inside the cell. We call that signal transduction with this kind of G protein coupled receptor. All right, so that's it for this chapter. So that's it for the test. Okay, anybody else? Anybody have any kind of questions about the test at all? What's important for the test? Exam figures, right? Make sure you can label things like that. And what else? Oh, the chemistry is important. The end of chapter questions are important. Online questions are important. Okay, so you got some definite tools to work with to do well on the test. Okay, I know it might seem like a lot, but at least you have tools to work with. Yeah. Oh, you got to speak up. Ten and 11? But that's not on the test coming up, right?
No, chapter one.
Oh, the additions.
Yeah,
like 10 and 11? Yeah, those are there for you to think about.
So, which one's right?
You know, hopefully I won't have, well, you need to think about those questions. Okay?
If I get it right on one and then wrong on the other.
Yeah.
And then I gotta do
go back and try to figure out why that is.
Okay?
Yeah, same question, same answers. Those are really good thought questions like that. I understand. That makes you even think harder. Okay? Okay, yeah. I'm not sure I know what you mean. How to calculate it? Those you got to do in lab, okay? Because we don't have time in lecture to go over that. Maybe during office hours or something, okay? But you guys just got to do those things in lab. Because I'm already behind a chapter and a half in lecture, okay? Okay. Yeah. The G proteins have this little spur. Okay, and it sticks up into this region right here, and that's a hydrophobic spur coming off of the G protein. And so that hydrophobic region is kind of trapped within what the oil boundary within the plasma membrane.
So the effector might be over here.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it just like they have a long string and it just keeps kind of moving?
Well, these molecules can all move around. They can all switch places. So the plasma membrane is very fluid. Not only can it wave up and down, but these molecules are moving around all over the place all the time. So this G protein is just going to wander around right on the inside surface of the plasma membrane because everything moves by diffusion.
So the length of that anchor doesn't change. It's just that the membrane kind
of... Yeah, all of these molecules are switching and being mixed around just like molecules in solution. So even though you put it here, you know, It will diffuse and cover the whole, it can wander around anywhere on the surface of the membrane.
It doesn't get cut off and go into the cell.
Doesn't get cut off. It stays stuck to the plasma membrane.
Okay.
Yeah. I do not.
I think these batteries are just dead as a problem.
Ah, okay.
Because it's not syncing. I'm not getting any activity with the thing.
Do you see, oh, you got an LED to come on. I couldn't even get that LED
it's
to come
there.
On.
Power button. I thought you knew about that.
Oh, where's the power button?
Power mute is right
oh,
there.
Oh, power mute. Okay. Yeah, I just saw mute. Okay. Oh, good. All right, who needs a sign-in sheet? Anybody need the sign-in sheet? Yeah, I'll just pass it down. And then scoot it down over this way. Well, that LEDs usually don't need a lot of power, but that kind of tells me the batteries are okay if it's lit up.
Well, nah, that could be just going to have a few seconds to
talk. Yeah, because it's a
trans. I don't know why they're not syncing. It should at least come up and sync. If I do this...
Yeah.
I'm not getting any activity on there. I mean,
do you get like an LED lighting up? Okay. 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 Question. Less than 100. I think the first test is maybe around 80 or so. So, and then maybe the tests get a little bit longer as the semester progresses. Something like that, once you get the feel of how to take a test in here, they probably get a little bit longer. So don't forget, is it better to have more questions or less questions?
More,
as long as you don't run out of time, right? So that's the deal. So there's a fair number. Some will be, a couple will be calculation questions, probably not very many of them because they take a longer period of time. Multiple choice, a number of them, and then some graphical questions, you know, like labeling, illustration or something. And those you should be able to zip through pretty quickly.
If you have a problem like, say, the nurse equation, will you have the...
I will have the equation there for you. You just have to know how to use it and to take information from the question and plug it into the equation. Okay. And that periodic table I'll cover up, but I'll give you the one that's on the internet for you to download, right? Because that's got the English words in it. All right, so let's talk about enzymes and energy, chapter 4. All right, so our first topic is enzyme. All right, and an enzyme is what we call a biological catalyst. Now, I'm not sure that means anything to you, but a catalyst is something that increases the rate of a chemical reaction, but a special kind of chemical reaction. So, for instance, probably at home, we all have this chemical compound that's called hydrogen peroxide. Raise your hand if you've heard of hydrogen peroxide. All right. What's a common use for hydrogen peroxide? It's like if you lacerate yourself, you can pour hydrogen peroxide on that laceration, and what does it do? It kind of bubbles up, right? And so it irrigates the wound, but it also oxygenates. The bubbles are oxygen, and oxygen kills a lot of bacteria, certain kinds of bacteria. So it's a way to clean the wound and to help disinfect the wound as well. All right, so hydrogen peroxide is this compound, H2O2. What does it kind of look like? Kind of looks like water, right? H2O2, except it's got, an extra oxygen in there. All right, so hydrogen peroxide actually can break down into oxygen and water. I didn't balance that equation, but if you want to balance it, you can go ahead and do that. All right, so this chemical reaction proceeds from left to right pretty easily. And if you have hydrogen peroxide in a bottle at home, all by itself, guess what it converts into? Into oxygen and water. And what kind of bottle is it normally stored in? A clear plastic bottle or what? A really dark one, right? Because this reaction is sped up when you put it in light, right? But even by itself, if you have a hydrogen peroxide bottle that you've had maybe for 10 or 15 years in your medicine cabinet, pretty much what's going to be in that bottle is just water and oxygen and not any hydrogen peroxide. So it will spontaneously break down, right? But it's going to take years and years and years to do that. But if you get some fresh hydrogen peroxide and put it on your skin, there is an enzyme that does what to that reaction rate? Speeds it up so that it happens even within seconds, right? You don't have to wait years and years and years and years. So what an enzyme will do is that it can't make a reaction happen that can't happen, right? Like, you can't take oxygen and water and make hydrogen peroxide out of it by pouring it in a bottle. This reaction only goes from left to right. So an enzyme just speeds up the rate, but it can't change the direction that a reaction will take place. All right, so an enzyme speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. So enzymes are used to control rates of chemical reactions in your body. You can turn an enzyme on or off, maybe using a G-protein coupled receptor, for instance. All right, so that's pretty important to know. Most enzymes are proteins. 99% of them are proteins, and you know a lot about proteins now. Okay, what's the basic building block of a protein? Amino acids. And you know the different hierarchical structural organization of a protein, right? Primary structure, secondary structure. They have a particular shape. Okay, and an enzyme, because of its particular shape, will have a binding site for a substrate. So this is what we're going to call a substrate. And the enzyme is going to produce something we call a product right here. All right, so this substrate has to bind to an enzyme. And what can you tell me about the shape of the substrate compared to the binding site on that enzyme? It's got to have a complementary shape. Sometimes we say we use a model of a lock and key model or a hand and glove. The shape of this substrate has to match the shape of the active site on the enzyme. And if they're different, then the substrate won't bind to the enzyme and the reaction won't get speeded up. All right, and the other concept is, and I'll talk about this, we'll develop this concept a little bit. The reason why it speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction because it lowers the activation energy for this particular reaction. So in particular, this reaction wants to happen, but there's some kind of barrier that prevents it from happening very quickly, and that barrier is taken away when you have an enzyme so that it speeds up the rate of the chemical reaction. Let's take a look at the next slide. All right, so this is a pretty good illustration right here in terms of activation energy. So let's take a look at these graphs. Let's take a look at this one right here, top left-hand side of this slide. Here is a plot of number of reactant molecules, which we call substrates, right, versus energy. So these substrates will have a certain energy associated with them that's described by this bell-shaped curve. Hey, it's working. Is that a battery? Cyberdyne.
Please insert your body type now.
Okay. Yeah, let's give it a shot. Now, so it works with this volume, either of those volume controls. Okay. So, what was I doing wrong?
The base. Something was wrong with the base. I had to replace the base unit. And they yanked it out of there and pulled the cord out of the back of it. So I'm going to go back and test the base unit.
Okay. All right, so does that help you here, maybe in the back? This is God talking to Dr. Gober. Are you there? Yes, I'm here. Okay, we'll see what happens with the recording unit. All right, so we have a plot right here of number of reactant molecules, right, versus the energy. Thanks so much, Mike.
When you're done,
yeah.
Button on top,
yeah.
Sit down for like 3 seconds.
Okay.
Dark. If you need to talk to a student privately.
Good.
Just hit that, it goes amber, and then you talk to them, unless you want everybody to hear it properly, and you go back on.
Good. Wonderful. And this is really nice, because now I can talk normally. I don't have to, like, shout at you the whole class period. That's going to be nice, I'm sure. All right, so what do we got to plot here? Number of reactant molecules versus the energy of a particular molecule. And it's described by a bell-shaped curve. So not all of the molecules that are in solution have the exact same energy. There are some molecules that have a high energy. There are some that have a low. But most of the molecules have what? Like a average energy. Right? So as you go to the extreme, you find less and less molecules with a particular energy level. Okay. So what we see, I'm losing my arrow. Let me get my arrow back. All right, so this shaded area just represents the number of molecules that have sufficient energy to undergo a particular reaction, right? And this is without an enzyme being present. So what can you tell me? Do most of the molecules have enough energy to proceed into products, or just a few of them? Just a few, just this one tip of the energy distribution. All right, but if we put an enzyme in solution, all right, we get the second graph over here, which is still just a plot of number of reactant molecules versus energy of the reactants. We don't change the energy of the reactants. The only thing we're changing is the activation energy for the particular reaction. And now what can you tell me about the number of molecules that have the proper energy level to proceed to products? Did it change at all? Did it get higher? Did the number get higher or less, or is it exactly the same? It went higher. Now half of the molecules have sufficient energy to proceed through the reaction. All right, so how is that? Let's look at another diagram. Here is a plot of energy, right, versus time for the non-catalyzed reaction. So here is, for instance, my car on top of a hill. And it has enough energy to do what? To start moving down the hill as a result. But there might have been a few hills that I parked on that I was concerned maybe my parking brake wasn't going to hold because it was a really old car. So what would I do? I would put something underneath the tire to prevent it from sliding down the hill. Now, would my car want to go down the hill? It certainly wants to go down the hill, but what's preventing it? That little block or chalk that's by the tire, right? So consider that an activation barrier or an energy barrier. As a matter of fact, maybe I'll even draw that on the board right here really quick. All right, so my car wants to roll down the hill. That's an allowed reaction. That will happen all by itself automatically. If I want to block that reaction from happening, let's just put a little block right here, like a brick or a stone or something. All right. The car still wants to roll down the hill, but it can't. All right. But let's just say that I didn't realize that block was there and I wanted to go home. What could I do? I could call out my friend with a big truck. All right, and do what? Bump into my car and push it over this energy barrier, and then what would happen to my car? It would roll down the hill, I could pop the clutch, right, and start the engine and go home. So that extra energy that I would need to get over this block is what we call the activation energy. Now what an enzyme does is really kind of fancy. What an enzyme does in this particular diagram doesn't add energy to my car right here. It just simply does what? Removes that block from the car so that all I have to do is just give it a little kick and the car is going to roll down the hill. So what an enzyme does, let me label this right here. What is that block right there? That is activation energy. And what does an enzyme do? It takes away or reduces the activation energy so that the reaction can proceed, which we see on this second diagram right over here. So the energy barrier is reduced with the addition of an enzyme so that this reaction can proceed to form products. Right? And it does that by increasing the number of molecules that have the sufficient energy to undergo that reaction. All right, so the ability of enzymes to lower activation energy requirement is due to the structure of the enzyme. All right, so enzymes are proteins. They have a highly ordered three-dimensional shape. We call that the conformation. All right, they contain pockets called active sites into which the substrates fit. And what kind of model in your mind would you use to describe that fit? Lock and key model, right? And enzymes act. They reduce activation energy by bringing substrates close together so that they can form products. Right, and I'll show you a pretty interesting example of that. So here we have a couple of molecules. We got substrate A, substrate B. Notice they have a particular shape. And then here we have an enzyme. And this spot on the enzyme matches up to the shape of the substrate, so this is what we call the active site. Right, so in order for the substrates A and B to form products, C and D, they have to bind to the enzyme. And when they bind to the enzyme, this forms a completely new molecule that we call the enzyme-substrate complex. So before products C and D can form, what molecule has to form? It is the enzyme-substrate complex. Okay. And then after the products are formed, the enzyme releases them from the active site, and guess what you get back over here? Take a look at this molecule, which kind of looks gray to me. Right? This is the, what is this molecule right here? That's the enzyme. And what's this molecule way over here? Enzyme. And what's the difference between the enzyme way over here on the left compared to the enzyme way over here on the right? You see any difference between them? The color is the same. What about the shape? Exactly the same. So if the structure doesn't change, what can you tell me about the function? It's the same. So the function of an enzyme doesn't change when it catalyzes a reaction. The only thing that changes is what? Reactants get converted into products. All right, so it reduces the activation energy barrier. A good way to think of this is that the reactants, or the substrates, have to come together in just a specific way in order to form a product. So let's look at these two markers right here. One's green, one's blue. All right, and we can form a product with these markers by connecting them together. All right, so here we have a blue-green molecule. All right. Now, in order to form a product, the blue-green molecule, how do these two markers, how do they have to touch each other in order to form a product? Can they touch each other like this?
No.
What about like that? Okay. What about like this?
No.
Or like that? Okay, or like this? Well, how many different ways can these markers touch each other in futile ways that won't ever result in a product that looks like this? Thousands of different ways, right? So two molecules are going to bump into each other, right, many, many, many times, but there's only one particular way that a reactant is going to form. They have to touch exactly in this way. As a matter of fact, even in this way, that won't form the same kind of product. Okay, that's going to be a side reaction. They have to bump into each other just exactly this way. And what an enzyme does is that it binds the two substrates, holds them in just the exact perfect way so that the substrates touch each other so that the reaction proceeds in the way that the cell wants to get this particular product without any side reactions. And when an enzyme does that, it does what? It reduces the activation energy barrier. Okay, so that's what an enzyme does. So in synopsis, overall, what does an enzyme do for a chemical reaction? It speeds up the rate of product formation. How does it speed up the rate? By reducing the activation energy. And you can see it does that by bringing substrates together with just the right orientation so that products can be formed. All right, so you know of different ways to change the shape of a protein. How can you change the shape of a protein? Yeah, how do you denature a protein? With what? Yeah, heat, by temperature, right? So as the temperature changes, the conformation of this enzyme is going to change, maybe a little bit at a time as you change the temperature. So what happens to this active site over here? It changes shape, right? But it has to have the proper shape to bind these substrates, right? If it doesn't have the proper shape, then the enzyme-substrate complex can't form. And if the enzyme-substrate complex can't form, then these products can't form. So the rate of this chemical reaction is dependent on temperature. Usually there's an optimal temperature. And the same thing for pH, right? The hydrogen ion concentration can change the shape of this enzyme. And salt concentration can change the shape of this enzyme, which could alter the rate of this chemical reaction, right? If it changes the amount of enzyme substrate complex that forms. All right, so that's how an enzyme works. Who's got any questions? Sorry about the interruptions during all of this, but I think it's really nice to have a microphone working. Okay. So make sure that you know that an enzyme doesn't get used up during a reaction. What does get used up during a reaction? What gets used up? What gets used up and what builds up? What gets used up, oh, I erased it, are the substrates. And what builds up during the enzyme-catalyzed reaction product? Okay. So basically, a catalyst speeds up the rate of a reaction, and an enzyme, since it's made from protein, we call it a biological catalyst, right? And a regular inorganic catalyst does not get used up during the reaction as well. All right, so let's talk about some nomenclature. Most enzymes, at least those that have been named in modern times, have an ASE added as a suffix after the name of the substrates that enzyme works on. All right, so there are classes of enzymes named according to the activity that they have. So a phosphatase, you know that's an enzyme because of this ASE on the end of the word. What is it? What's the substrate that it works on? It has something to do with? Yeah, with phosphates. Have you ever run into a molecule where a phosphate is an important group? Like what? What's the name of a molecule that has a phosphate functional group? How about something like what? ATP. How many phosphate groups does it have? Three. And we talked about one earlier today. GTP. Okay? So these are some substrates for phosphatases. All right, so a phosphatase will remove a phosphate group. A kinase, all right, is one that will add a phosphate group to another molecule. So you can see that. What's the activity of a phosphatase compared to a kinase? Yeah, a phosphatase removes and a kinase adds. So one is taking away, one is adding. What's the nature of that relationship? It's antagonistic to each other, right? So these are a perfect pair of enzymes that can perfectly control and balance some kind of metabolism inside the cell because they work in opposition to each other. All right, so the name may specify the substrate of the enzyme and the activity as well. All right, so lactate dehydrogenase. It works on what molecule? Lactate. We haven't talked about lactate yet, but we will. And its activity is dehydrogenase. It takes a hydrogen off of that particular molecule. All right, so it's really handy to know nomenclature because then you don't have to memorize what substrate it works on and what the activity is. Right, just by looking at the name, you can tell that. All right, so here are a number of enzymes that we have in our body. And yeah, these are all real important. How do you know these are all enzymes right here? Because you see an ASE at the end of them. Here's catalase. We talked about this reaction previously. That catalyzes what? The conversion of hydrogen peroxide into water and oxygen. All right, so this reaction will happen all by itself naturally, right, but just not in a very rapid fashion unless there is catalase. And your body produces catalase all the time. Okay, plants produce catalase because hydrogen peroxide is produced by cells, but it's a fairly toxic compound. And so it's broken down by enzymes that our cells produce into water and oxygen. And what can you tell me about the toxicity of water and oxygen? Basically, they're not toxic to us, right? So catalase is a detoxifying enzyme that speeds up this reaction and that protects the cell. Here's another real important reaction. We have CO2 and water that can combine to form carbonic acid. But what about CO2? Have you ever heard of CO2? Carbon dioxide. Yeah, what about carbon dioxide? You breathe it out. Yeah, that's an excretory product. Right, so carbon dioxide is important it's an important byproduct of respiration, and we need to get it out of our bodies. And this is because your body makes so much CO2, right? It involves carbonic acid, And we're going to study this reaction pretty extensively in this class. All right. Amylase is an enzyme that can break starch down. What's the building block of starch? Glucose, right? It's just thousands of glucose molecules all joined together. Amylase can break starch down, or it can digest starch, right? And it can form disaccharide maltose, which then needs to be digested down further to give glucose. So what kind of reaction is this? Starch plus water making maltose. What kind of reaction is that? I heard the right answer, so you're right. But not everybody said. It is when you need water to break something down into smaller molecules, that's a hydrolysis reaction, right? That's a little review for the test. Okay? And ribonuclease is an enzyme because it breaks down RNA. Okay? Into what? Ribonucleotides. All right. Can you remember what a ribonucleotide kind of looks like as opposed to a deoxyribonucleotide? All right. So enzyme activity is defined as the rate substrates are converted into products. Right? And we can plot enzyme activity versus some parameters, for instance, like temperature. All right? So what does temperature really mean in terms of a solution, something in water? What is temperature? As temperature increases, what happens to things in that solution? Yeah, things are just moving around faster. They might be vibrating or wiggling or whatever. So the mixing of everything increases as the temperature increases. So it means that these molecules are moving faster in solution. They're diffusing around faster. So the chance of them bumping into each other in the right way, what, increases as the temperature increases. And the rate that they bump into the active site, right, so that a catalyzed reaction can take place, increases as temperature increases. So if we plot out enzyme activity versus temperature, we see that there is an optimal temperature where the rate of a reaction is at a maximum right here. And we see that that usually happens around 37 degrees, which is our body temperature, because temperature also affects how a protein molecule is spinning around and vibrating and wiggling. And if an enzyme is changing shape, the active site is changing, and that's going to affect the rate of product formation. Right, which is what? Enzyme activity right here. Right, then all of a sudden we see a precipitous drop in enzyme activity as the temperature goes close to 100 degrees. What happens to, how would you explain this to somebody? Why is something dropping right here? Why is the activity of that enzyme decreasing? Because denaturation is taking place. Right, the shape of that enzyme has changed so dramatically that it is no longer anything like its native conformation. So the active site is completely destroyed. And if the active site is destroyed, what cannot form? Let's go back. What can't form if the active site is destroyed? Because you've changed the shape of this enzyme by denaturing it. The enzyme substrate complex can't form. And as a result, then, products cannot form. Okay? So the rate of product formation decreases. Now, what else can you tell me? What happens when an enzyme is denatured? Can you ever get the activity back? No, you can't, right? So you can cool it down, but you can never hop back on this curve and increase the activity, right? So once you cook a hamburger, it's cooked, even if you put it back in the refrigerator. All right, but not only temperature, but if you plot out enzyme activity versus pH, you notice that various enzymes have an optimal pH. Because the pH will change the shape of that particular enzyme. It's going to change the active site and also the rate of the enzyme substrate complex formation. All right, so pepsin is an enzyme that works in the stomach. It has an optimal pH of less than 2 because the pH of your stomach is highly acidic. And that's necessary for the initial digestion of peptide bonds to digest proteins. Salivary amylase is an enzyme that breaks down starch and that is found in saliva. Right? So the pH of saliva is about 7. Right? Trypsin is an enzyme that we see in the small intestine and that is at a very high pH. Again, that's a very radical kind of pH. And again, that's for protein digestion, to break peptide bonds. Right, so you can see that there's a big change in pH as food moves, or digesting food moves from the stomach into the small intestine. So every enzyme has a particular pH that it will work the best at. And this is just a table that shows various enzymes that are important in our body and what pH they work at. And that is a guide to where you would find them in the body. Like, for instance, trypsin we talked about. Lipase. What's the substrate for lipase? Lipids, like a triglyceride. Right, so what would lipase do? It would convert a triglyceride into glycerol and fatty acids. Okay. I don't think I need to spend much time about that. But this is an important slide. All right, some other molecules that work with enzymes to speed up the rate of a chemical reaction. All right, so these are necessary for normal activity of enzymes. These two compounds are called cofactors versus coenzymes. A cofactor is a small metal ion, for instance, like calcium or magnesium or manganese or maybe even copper or zinc or selenium. Actually, somebody talked about one of these things, brought this to my attention early before class. They had a question about a factor that needs cobalamin, which is based on cobalt. A little ion of cobalt is necessary. Right? These are what we call cofactors. So these are these organic or inorganic compounds? Organic or inorganic? Inorganic, because what's the definition of an organic compound? It's got to have carbon and it's got to have hydrogen, right? And these elements don't have either of those, right? So these are what we call cofactors. All right, a coenzyme, on the other hand, is something that's necessary for normal enzyme activity, but these are large organic molecules. And so I think I have a picture at the end of this slide presentation, but it's not anything that you have to memorize. But when you look at them, you're going to see that it's a very big, large, complex molecule that has a lot of carbon atoms bound to hydrogen atoms, and maybe some other components to them as well. Coenzymes are derived from vitamins. And what a coenzyme does, right, is that it transports small molecules from maybe one part of the cell to another, or from one enzyme system to another. So it's a little bit different than a cofactor. So let's do a little example. I like to use this marker to write on the board. Okay, so it's a nice functional little molecule. But let's just say somebody in the second row would like to write something with my marker right here. All right, so we're going to employ somebody to do that. I'm going to give this marker to you, and you're going to turn around and give it to somebody that needs to use it over there. Okay, so what were you? Were you a coenzyme or a cofactor? Okay, I want everybody to think about that for a second. Okay, are you like a little metal ion, or are you a big organic molecule? You're a big organic molecule, and what did you do? You just transported a little molecule from one place to another. Oh, you're being a coenzyme again. Good, thank you. Yeah, I'd like to have that back. Good. So a coenzyme just transports things around from one place to another, or from one enzyme to another. But did our coenzyme modify the marker? No, it just transferred it from one place to another. Okay. But it's necessary for various metabolic pathways to operate. All right, so cofactors and coenzymes, well, we're still talking about them. In particular, let's think about cofactors. All right, so again, what is a cofactor? A little inorganic molecule or a big organic molecule? The little inorganic molecule. These can bind to an enzyme. So here is an enzyme. Right, and when it binds to the enzyme, look what happens to the active site. This thing kind of wraps around a little bit more, so it kind of develops this little leg over here. So now it forms a more proper active site that matches up with the substrate. Right, so cofactors are necessary to build or to have the active site go into the proper shape so that substrates can bind. So what do we call this thing right here? That is the enzyme substrate complex. Now, what can form after the enzyme-substrate complex forms? The products can form, right? But in order to form this enzyme-substrate complex, this cofactor has to bind to the enzyme, and that changes the shape of the active site so that the substrates can bind to it. Okay, and that's a temporary binding. That's maybe not permanent. So sometimes a cofactor will bind to a site other than the active site, and sometimes it can actually bind to some place within the active site that then makes that active site match up with the substrates more properly. Okay, but not just necessarily the shape, but what can you tell me about this molecule right here? What else does it have besides shape? It's got charge, right? So maybe there could be a charge in an electronic interaction, right? Like an ionic bond, almost like an ionic bond that's forming, right? So not just the shape, but just the electrical interaction. So if this is a positive ion that binds here, what can you tell me about the substrate in this region? Then you're going to have a negative region right here that's going to help binding of that particular substrate. Okay, so that's a really good example of a cofactor. All right, many enzymes are produced in an inactive form. And this is really good because the pancreas produces many digestive enzymes. Right? And if the pancreas produced them in an active form, guess what would happen to the pancreas? And unfortunately, this happens sometimes. The pancreas is going to be digested. Right? And it's a terrible thing when that happens, when somebody gets pancreatitis or pancreatic cancer. All right, so enzymes are produced in an inactive form that protects, for instance, the pancreas from self-digestion so that it doesn't digest itself. And then those enzymes are carried by a duct. Well, what duct takes it to the small intestine? That's a little blast from the past. Okay, pancreatic duct, and then it joins with the common bile duct, and then it goes into the small intestine. So then the ducts carry these inactive forms of the enzyme to the small intestine, and then they're activated within the small intestine where they do their job, and those enzymes don't digest the small intestine because the small intestine knows how to protect itself from these enzymes. All right, many of these enzymes are activated by phosphorylation, and they're inactivated by dephosphorylation. How would you phosphorylate? What kind of enzyme would you use to phosphorylate a digestive enzyme? All right, so we're talking about phosphate, and we learned two enzymes. What were the names of the two enzymes? There's one called a phosphatase, and one called a kinase. All right, so you got to remember which one, what's the job of a kinase? It adds a phosphate, right? And the phosphatase takes the phosphate off. So this can be used as a switch to turn an enzyme on or off. So this is a nice regulatory mechanism. Right. Others can be activated by other small molecules that we call ligands, and some can be activated by second messengers. Well, what was the very last slide that we saw in the last chapter that was a second messenger? Like a G protein, right? Sliding around on the inside surface of the membrane, when it bumps into an enzyme, it can activate that enzyme or deactivate it, right? It would activate it if, for instance, it was a kinase, and it might deactivate it if it involved a phosphatase. All right, so the interesting thing about enzymes is that they can be characterized similarly to receptors can, right? And some characteristics of receptors was that they can saturate. So here we have a plot of reaction rate versus substrate concentration. So if we hold the enzyme concentration constant, if the enzyme concentration doesn't change, and we increase substrate concentration, right, then that increases the rate of the reaction up to a certain point, right, until all the active sites are bound with substrate. And when all the enzyme is bound to substrate, if we increase the substrate concentration, the rate of that reaction cannot increase because all the active sites are bound with the substrate. Okay, and we call that saturation. All right, so we're going to start a week from today on this slide right here, law of mass action. We already mentioned that. We call that Le Chatelier's principle. Okay, and then we'll get into some metabolic panel. We're almost done with this chapter. Oh, look at these big organic molecules here. What are those big organic molecules? Cofactors or coenzymes? They're coenzymes. Coenzymes. Sign-in sheet. Where's that sign-in sheet at? Do I have it? No.